Blog Talk Radio.
Well, folks, welcome to another edition of Politics Done Right. I am Egberto Willis, your host, and I hope to have a wonderful show with what I hope to be a lot of participation from those that are listening. These are actually pretty important subjects: the minimum wage, a living wage, and should we really go into war? Should we really be going to Syria? Well, let's discuss that. Remember, folks, the number is 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. If you want to speak, please push 1. As usual, you know I start with my monologue, one of my blogs, or a couple of my blogs, depending on how it goes. This week was consumed with talk of going to war. And while every moral and ethical person must feel the pain and suffering of maimed and killed Syrians in their civil war, entry into this war by America will make things no better. This war is likely between several groups of authoritarians that do not have the interests of everyday Syrians at hand. Unfortunately, the drumbeat to war does nothing. It does nothing but drown out the civil war we have here at home. While we are not killing our citizens with napalm and chemical weapons and bombs or guns, we are killing them nonetheless with policies that kill over time, whether it is from a corrupt healthcare system or a dysfunctional economic system. This week, fast food workers continued their protest, demanding a hike in the minimum wage to a living wage. Unfortunately, unless all Americans engage to demand that we, the people, the government, those of us that are really in charge, those of us that supposedly control this country, those of us that need to get in, it will go absolutely nowhere. You know, unemployment is high, and, you know, the way these guys believe, there will be always those that are unemployed that are willing to take the crumbs. Something is better than nothing. These guys, the plutocracy, they are looking at the pool of unemployed. They know they don't have to do better. That is why we must. That is why we must. Again, folks, 646-929-2495. Hit 1. I'm about to go read the blog, this particular post. It's actually an article, this one. It's going to be featured at the Daily Coast on Sunday. I think it's going to be around 8 or 9 in the afternoon or in the evening on Sunday is when it is due to be posted. But here goes the blog, and the title is, and please don't be shocked by the title, listen to the narrative, and then let's talk about it. Goes this way. The title of the post is going to be America's Form of Capitalism Kills Free Enterprise and Democracy. Here's a chart. Many believe that capitalism is synonymous with free enterprise and democracy. Capitalism is neither free enterprise nor democracy. After all, China is now a capitalist country. No one believes that China is a democratic country. This conflation has allowed all attempts to attenuate the deficiencies of capitalism to be construed as that grand evil, socialism or communism. Americans would do well to understand the differences and how they affect their lives. Under a poor, unfettered capitalist structure, the only thing that matters is growth, the real appreciation of capital. The shareholders of companies want the highest return on their investment. The managers of their monies effect whatever necessary actions to achieve this. If the American worker becomes too expensive, they present a false narrative stating that free trades lift all workers. They then invest in politicians, forcing them to pass free trade agreements like NAFTA and TPP, TPP being the Trans-Pacific Partnership. If a profitable patent is about to expire, they get it extended by all means necessary. If an allowable level of pollution affects the bottom line, they get the law changed. If a pipeline or transmission line needs to be built, use eminent domain to usurp the rights of the property owner. You get the picture? Free enterprise would have all play under the same market rules of supply and demand. Corporations would have no advantages over the small businesses they have today. In a real free enterprise system, a corporation could not have exclusivity in a cable or some utility market. In a free enterprise system, a corporation could not prevent a city or private entity from building out free Wi-Fi, which they've done in many cities. They've prevented these cities who've wanted to offer affordable Wi-Fi to their citizens. They've blocked it, corporations, in as much as they will not provide an affordable alternative. Continuing with my blog, or with the post. While the Tea Party has been running around preaching about Americans losing their freedom, their boogeyman was purposefully ill-chosen. The ones that are hurt the most by the policies they support are those they purport to defend. Support of policies that removes the power of the elected government to regulate, in effect, relegates that power to an unelected few whose sole concern is the maximization of their wealth and well-being. And I should add to that, which isn't in the article, at the detriment of the working middle class and the poor. MSNBC Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski visited Detroit on Thursday. Inasmuch as Detroit is in bankruptcy, where the pensions of thousands remain at risk, they were extolling the virtues of the titans of industry who brought back a few jobs from Mexico to Detroit. Hooray! Did they forget that these titans of industries went to greener pastures of lower wages way before the collapse of the economy in 2008? Steve Rattner made it explicitly clear that while auto sales recovered, profits recovered, and productivity increased dramatically, the new jobs came in at substantially lower wages. In other words, instead of employees making their higher wages, given that less people were manufacturing the same number of cars, They are paid way less than before. They are not partaking of the spoils from higher productivity and efficiency. Today, fast food workers throughout the nation had a walkout, meaning yesterday, 2 days ago. They want $15 per hour. A society must demand that those who work earn a living wage. That should be a societal contract. Wages that are too low force Americans to work more than one job just to subsist. This removes the freedom they would otherwise have for upward mobility, the time necessary to improve themselves through school or some vocation. Ironically, it is the minimum wage. If the minimum wage was indexed to inflation, it would be $10.74 today. Sadly, a reporter commented that a higher minimum wage is unlikely and that employers did not need to do it voluntarily because of a glut of employable workers caused by high unemployment. Those that blame workers and unions for companies moving overseas or moving to the greener pastures of low wages must ask themselves a simple question. Which is more virtuous? Maximizing one's benefits and wages for real work? The guy who sweeps the floor, the guy who empties the garbage, the guy who builds a reactor, the guys who build a plane, or maximizing shareholder value simply for having capital? That guy that sits behind a desk, behind his computer, just looking at his wealth appreciate. Which is more virtuous? Yet, because of what unfettered and poorly regulated capitalism has effected on the American economy and on workers, the power and freedom to bargain is all but gone. A corporate-controlled government is forcing the government to live up to their narrative. Government does not create jobs. The private sector does. False. If Americans were really free as opposed to being enslaved by the tenets of unfettered capitalism, government would be creating millions of jobs. The dilapidated freeway system would be rebuilt. High-speed railways between major hubs would be built. Canals and storage lakes would be built to bring the flooded east to the arid west. Reforestation throughout the country would be effected. Many more jobs waiting for a system that can attach the American worker to an American job. There are millions of jobs that need to be done. The failure of this man-made economy prevents it. Those who have studied macro and microeconomics may balk at this point, but you need not, because it really isn't in any way different than what you've learned. It's just that we've had a narrative, folks, today that have corrupted what an economy should be. It should be noted that an economic system is not divine. It is man-made. If the current economic system works inordinately well for a few and not so well for most, then it has inherently failed. If there are millions of workers looking for jobs and millions of jobs waiting to be done and they cannot be matched, it means the economic system has failed. If the system inhibits change, then one is enslaved to that system. If one is enslaved to that system, one is not free. There is no democracy if one is not free. Folks, that will be posted at the Daily Coast on the front page, I think, between 8 and 9 tomorrow evening. I see there's a call on 908. So before I get to any other vlogs or any other statements, I just want to get a commentary. But folks, please remember, the number is 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. I would love to hear from a lot of you. Push one if you want to talk. Remember, push one if you want to talk. I'm bringing 908 now. Area code 908. Who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hey, Egberto, John from Jersey.
John from Jersey, I don't think I've heard from you in a little while, my buddy. How you doing?
Yeah, I've been busy.
You've been busy?
How you been?
Well, been hanging in there, trying to get our movement to do what movements do for
the working
middle class. Talk to me.
This is a good one. I'll tell you what I heard today. Very interesting. Well, of course, you know that, as you said, they're in New York City and a bunch of the other cities. They've been out there for the push for, you know, even up to $15 an hour wages
minimum
at
wage.
Fast food restaurants. You know, they're asking for that themselves, not necessarily asking for the state minimum to be changed or the, you know, but they're asking for it themselves, you know.
Right.
Or a federal minimum, you know. But which was very interesting is there sort of seems to be a breaking point which occurred in New York City, which is the capital of, you know, restaurant industry in the world as far as all the different kind of cuisines and everything. And a lot of these guys who, let's say, these side order cooks to up to low-level chefs, between $9 and $15 an hour, and chefs between, let's say, $15 to $25 an hour in New York City, they can't make it here. And they're leaving in droves, and they're leaving to cheaper cities like Portland and Seattle.
Probably and Houston.
Everywhere else. And what they're having trouble right now is they know that if they don't do something about it, New York City will lose its status as the best restaurant city in America because of the fact that these guys are going to go out in droves. They cannot actually find, like before they would have like a job application and they would have tons of guys just waiting to fill the jobs. Now they say they're down to like, just for an example, what used to be 200 people trying to apply for a job. They have 4 people applying for a job. And that's pretty pathetic. So they, you know, and of course, out of that so many pooled, you know, there's not necessarily qualified people or good qualified chefs. So they're hurting. They're going to be hurting. And that means that somewhere else in the country or even in the world, depending, whatever, they're going to lose this status to someone else.
That is so true, John. That is absolutely so true. But the question that you have to ask yourself is why these titans of industry that one would believe that so smart would somehow not see the tea leaves or not read the tea leaves? Do they care? Well, maybe they don't. Maybe because they are so – but.
Now they do. They realize here's a breaking point, and the wages are so low, and people can't afford to live here, in let's just say New York, and they're going to leave in droves. And then what does that mean? You know, that why would other people pay the high prices that they pay in the restaurants in New York? That would be a big concern later on for the restaurant owners.
Right. Absolutely. So I mean, there is really no point. You know, I mean, it is sad to see, but I tell you something, John, and I think I placed that in the blog, and that is people have to, what's the word? All of America has to really get engaged because it's not just about those minimum wage workers that are getting hurt. It is all Americans, whether they understand it or not. Not
right.
Having folks making that. Let's just give an example. I am a small businessman. I sell software. You know what I mean? A minimum wage person can't. The type of software that I sold, granted, wouldn't be sold to a whole lot of these folks. But even if I decided to write certain types of games for, let's say, an iPad, not an iPad, but an iPhone or a Droid phone. The mere fact that we have a large percentage of our population who would be candidates to purchase that type of a product, they can't afford it. They don't have the disposable income to afford it. And what
right.
is an economy but the movement of money around the economy? So what
right.
were,
Henry
what,
Ford oh, said it. Henry Ford said this all this. He said, look, I'm going to start paying my employees good wages, and then the rich businessmen said, what the heck are you doing that for? He said, so they can buy back my cars, you know?
Exactly.
But the thing I find is interesting is, okay, yeah, these companies like McDonald's and them are still going to just tell other people, just go get another job. You know, that's all they're going to say. But I find that this story very interesting with the restaurants in New York because it became a natural breaking point. It became a natural breaking point. See, like, sometimes they could just not care. But when it's going to affect their business now, and people are going to say the quality of food in New York is not worth its weight, and it's, you know, the money I'm spending, you know, and there's a breaking point, and people are going to either go to Hoboken, New Jersey, or eat at other places that they necessarily won't eat in Manhattan. They'll forego to eat in the city for a nice meal, and they'll go back home to New Jersey, or they'll go back to Connecticut, or they'll go back to, you know, Brooklyn or wherever. But they're not going to eat in Manhattan, therefore.
Yeah, it makes no sense. And you're bringing up just one issue, you know. I mean, just one issue as to how this impacts the economy. Let me put a call out again for folks to call in. Folks, the number is 646-929-2495. I see many of you listening on the phone. Nobody has the hands up other than John from Jersey. Give me a call and tell me what you think. Tell me what you think about what's going on with the minimum wage. After we talk about the minimum wage, we can get into talking about Siri. I don't want to hit that right away, but give me a call and let me know what you think. I got a lot of pushback. This week I've been talking a whole lot about employment and capitalism and that sort of thing. And as you know, the first thing that happens whenever you talk about, whenever you hit capitalism, it doesn't, we have been so indoctrinated into believing that somehow there was first capitalism and then or freedom or something like that, or that somehow capitalism as it is practiced in America has anything to do with our freedom. Because we are so misinformed about this, anytime somebody talks about anything that somehow disparage how we are practicing our current economy, the first thing that they equate you to is some sort of a communist or some sort of a socialist who wants the state in control and that sort of thing. The fact that we have been so indoctrinated, I think, has hurt not just the average Americans, but most Americans. We sit down here and we think, why do things work exactly the way they do?
Right.
Why
I
is
agree
it...
with you, Roberto.
Yeah.
I agree with you. And there's another thing. You were saying, like, let's say the 7.25 thing, and if they had kept it up with inflation, it would have been, what did you say, 9 or 10?
It's 10.74.
Okay, 10.74. But the other thing was they went back to the 50s, and they compared it to, like, the resources of the 50s for which you were able to buy in comparison to today. And then actually it would be like something like $17 or $18. But considering what they push the bounds of production, okay, and such, you know, they push the bounds of production. And considering how the bounds of production have been, compare the wealthy versus those that are not in the wealth category. They say that the minimum wage, believe it or not, okay, would be as close to about $24 now, considering the push of, okay, we got less workers doing certain jobs, and we've got more production out of people, and the minimum wage right now would be close to $24 an hour considering things.
You know, that I don't know if people understand exactly what you're saying there, but what you've just said is extremely important because I don't think people are quite going to get exactly what you've said. What you've said is if you look at what we are producing based on the amount of workers working, if you normalize all this information, folks, the efficiency increase that we've had in this country, and that's how economists talk about it, the productivity increases, improved efficiency, would make that worker under the same conditions in the past be making what? Did you say it was, John, $24 an hour?
It was 23-something. It was close to $24 an hour. That we would all be at to where that minimum wage would be right about that now, which shows you, you know, we'd be flying high like we were in the 80s, basically. You know, maybe, of course, they wouldn't graduate it as fast as that. Yes, they'll never do that, and they never do, you know. But the fact is, if you take into account the way things are that they've, you know, oh, we've increased production via computers, via this, via that, all that, production of people and such, you know, the assembly lines and all that kind of stuff, the average person who would therefore be taking into account for what they would get back and gain back for the production work that they've been doing, right? It'd be about $24 an hour. Close to it.
That's amazing. That is simply amazing. Now, 630, I'm coming to you next, but I want to say something before I come to you, so hang with me here. It's interesting. First of all, let's be clear. That money didn't disappear. The loss in wages between the $7 something minimum wage that we have today compared to the $24 it would be based on the efficiency increase and productivity increases.
Right, never get to that. It would never close as that. But
that's not what I want to say, John.
It really needs to be adjusted, that's for sure.
You're correct. You're absolutely correct. But let me put it even in more sinister terms. That money didn't disappear. That money went directly into the coffers of the 1% or less, or 1 or 2%. What I mean by that is, as you noted before, if you look at what has happened progressively to the income and wealth disparity, what you've just stated could numerically be shown to have been transferred to the wealth upstairs. In other words, the working middle class did not partake of the efficiency that they themselves generated. It's sad, but it's true. Now,
let me say one other point.
That doesn't include this,
considering how much they brought down the percentage for capital gains. So it's tremendously.
There you go again. Absolutely. I mean, and that's a concept folks don't understand because. And I want to put what you just said in a deeper context, John. Capital gains is the earning of the rich, pretty much, you know, how their stocks capitalize, which have constantly been capitalizing or increasing in value. But wages is what the average working middle class person gets. While as a percentage of their wages, they paid 7.7%. Well, I'm going to be real here. They paid 14-point-something% of their wages in Social Security and a higher marginal rate on taxes because capital gains is capped at like 15% or used to be capped at 15% or something like that.
Well,
what does that mean?
It's 10%.
Right. And what
So like with their wages, let's say as Romney was, you know, with his wages and his other, you know, investments and this and that, somehow he was paying about 13% tax.
Right. So it turns out that the average American was paying a larger percentage of their income on taxes than the wealthy. What that means is the wealthy's income is allowed to grow faster than the income from the middle class, the working middle class. And what's worse is the working middle class wasn't growing. They were falling behind. But my calls are starting to come in. John, so stay with me. I'm leaving you hot so that you can jump in. And I'm going to 630. 630, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hey, Gerto, Jeff McKinley.
Hey, Jeff, how you doing, buddy?
Good, how are you?
So far, so good. My dear listeners, Jeff is my libertarian buddy, so we're going to have an alternative message here, which is something that we encourage on this show. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, well, I guess along those same lines, too, one of my favorite philosophers is Robert Nozick, and in Anarchy, State, and Utopia, in the preface of it, he says that there is room for words on subjects other than last words. So there's always another discussion to be had And it's not like anyone's person's opinion is set in concrete. So in that same spirit, but a couple things on the minimum wage. One is survey was done a while ago, but that's just the one that I found. 80% of the economists agree that minimum wages increases unemployment, and the wage that you earn if you're unemployed is zero. Also, once people gain skills, they move up very quickly, and only 2% of the workforce that's earning minimum wage is over 25. So what it is it affects young people, and it affects their ability to, have on-the-job training. And it messes with the pricing systems. And overall, those effects are very detrimental.
Okay. Is that the comment that you wanted to make, Jeff? Because I want to refute that kind of like right away. All right. First of all, I don't know the report that you have. And, the two of us are going to use words because we don't have the documentation immediately in front of us.
Which statistic?
Okay. The part that says that 80% of economists agree that an increase in minimum wage somehow increases unemployment, because last I read from Krugman, as we speak, I'm actually looking it up here. Krugman has the definitive, or one of the definitives, as I'm going to take your word for it, as one of the definitive that at worst, increasing the minimum wage does nothing for employment, meaning it doesn't increase it nor it doesn't reduce it, which if that is the case, we want it, because the net gain would be stimulative. But we can talk about that a little bit further later.
And I think I know what you're referring to. There was a study that was done comparing when a minimum wage between Pennsylvania and New Jersey, one of them had raised their minimum wage, and then they went in and then they looked at it and compared the two. And from what I've been able to read about it, it was a monopsony, which is the opposite of a monopoly. A monopsony is where there is one market or one purchaser of a service. And what it is that in this situation, that they were looking at and was part of this theory, and I have to say I haven't been able to delve really far into it, but the employers are able, they are the one of the few purchasers of in the labor market. And that was kind of how this whole crux was, how the whole argument was made in a monopsonistic market, which I don't know that it applies to the overall economy.
Can I say something?
Please come on. And Eric Coates, 320 and 412, I see that you are hot. I mean, that you have your hands up. I'll be coming to you in a little bit. Go ahead, John.
I'd like to debate that a little bit with your libertarian friend here. How come Australia has about the lowest unemployment and has the highest minimum wage? Okay, the United States back in the 50s had the highest tax rating back in the day and had the lowest unemployment back then.
Okay, well, in Australia, the minimum wage doesn't apply to younger people, so they hire in younger people. In addition, like most of the McDonald's and such over there, which I think this study really came out of, they have a higher end products. They have lattes and they have other products that they're able to premium price. So one,
are you saying that they produce better stuff than we do in America? I mean, America, who has the biggest best pharmaceutical companies in the world and some of the highest end, other things in the world? Is that what you're saying?
No, not at all. If somebody wants a regular cup of coffee, they want a regular cup of coffee, and they're going to pay for that cup of coffee. But if they want, a latte, they're going to pay for it. It has nothing to do with quality.
Yeah, but we can get a
latte
or a cup of coffee here, too. What are you talking about?
Right. But the cup of coffee has a smaller profit margin on it. If they retooled their business, that's the difference between Walmart and Costco. Costco has a much more highly affluent clientele that comes to their store, and they're able to premium price those. So they have more of a profit margin and they have less employees. It all comes into the business model, and there's multiple factors as far as a business model. And it's hard to compare the two. Here.
But you're talking, but you're not countering it.
One at a time, John.
You're not countering it.
Here, let me try them. They hire people in. No, not everybody makes that wage, number one. So their workforce, and I don't know what percentage of it is earning about the minimum wage that the United States has. Here's something that
they're earning higher,
explain.
Way higher.
Well,
in Australia.
Yeah, some of them are, but the younger people.
No, the minimum wage is a lot higher in Australia than it is here. A lot higher.
No, but they have just like in the United States, they have exceptions for farm workers and some other statuses. They have the same thing in Australia. So the McDonald's and such over there, they're not paying everybody $15 an hour. They're paying them lower. They're paying them about what they get paid here.
But again, their minimum wage overall is higher than our minimum wage.
Right, but
their unemployment is lower, a lot lower than here.
Well, let me just say one of the other things. They have a much better social safety net. Jeff, I'm going to let you continue into the discussion and John as well, but there are other callers, and I want to keep it vibrant. And as other people have other ideas or come in with other values, we can all refute or comment about them. So stick with me, guys. 320, I'm coming to you. 320, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, sir. Who are you?
Oh, good. Yeah, good. This is Bill Brown in Pine City, Minnesota, USA. Glad to be online. I'm
Ray,
doing
what,
fine.
What is your
and
name?
You?
What's your
My
last name,
Bill?
My
name is Bill. Bill Brown, B-R-O-W-N, good common name.
Okay.
I got a couple
Brown.
Things to say.
Please
number one, there are two types of people in the world, those who work for money and those who have money work for them. Now, most of us are people who work for money all over the world. And all the models that we can study about minimum wage and products and all of that and labor movements and peasants and slaves and whatever, basically what it boils down to is what does it take to
hold
earn...
Bill, hold on one second. For anybody who's on a speakerphone, could you please mute your mic? I don't want to mute it because I want everybody to be in the conversation, but please mute your mic if you're on speakerphone. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I'm away from my computer.
Okay,
so
go ahead.
What it takes is how long do you have to work as a working person who earns money? How long do you have to work to earn a white shirt for Sunday? That's it. If you got to work 1 hour or 3 hours, but it should be a worldwide standard because we're all human beings all over the world. And that's a standard to go by, or a pair of shoes, the same pair of shoes all over the world. So that's what we need to have as a future standards, the future models to go by, instead of comparing McDonald's for an hour over here or over there or whatever, because ownership is going to get the cheapest labor wherever they can, whatever they can, with the soybeans called hamburgers. Now, as long as we've got workers, analysts, pitted against each other trying to call the cheapest shots, we've got our analytic warfare going on. Clear the slate, and let's look and see what can we do for the workers. Minimum wage should be forgotten. The livable wage with the package of health care in there, 4 week of vacation, ongoing education. And that's basically what I got to say.
Bill, let me first address, first of all, that is a very intelligent comment. The thing about, we shouldn't be talking about minimum wage, we should be talking about livable wage. And here's the interesting thing. I am originally from Central America, a place called Panama, okay? They have something called, right, and they call it Las Bolsas. In other words, what the government does and the way they figure what the minimum payment is going to be in that country is, and by the way, there is poverty, but everybody is well-fed or whatever. But what they do is they have a totality of what a complete grocery bill would be, home bill would be, and all of that, and that is how they set what the minimum is an employee with X amount of children or whatever working for should get. The reality is that is what our economy. Notice in when I gave the preamble to and 210 and 412, I'm coming to you next. Notice what I've always said in including in the document that I wrote in the article that's going to appear at Daily Coast, that we must ensure that whatever we pay people, because the economy is man-made, so we are
exactly.
It's not, and that is where Jeff and I may differ a bit. And Jeff, later on, we'll be able to discuss that. But the economy is man-made. This mythical market that everybody talks about. I wrote a piece on religion earlier this morning or last night, where I actually stated that that those people that believe so much in this market are idol worshippers, because they believe this invisible thing, this invisible mechanic that is really man-created, is somehow or should somehow supersede what we need in a country. As an example, in the document that I just read that's going on Daily Coast, I said, if we made ourselves work for ourselves instead of attempting to have an economy who's run by a bunch of plutocrats work for us, we would be building canals that move water from the east side of this country to the west side of this country, which would create a whole lot of jobs, but the plutocracy does not want that. And they don't want that because what you get is full employment, and if you get full employment, somehow then labor is at the same behest or at the same value as capital. So capital and labor can really negotiate on equal terms, and they don't want that. But keep that in the back of your head, everybody that's listening, and I need to bring in 210.
Oh.
Yeah, 210, come on in, my brother. Who am I speaking with?
Yeah, it's John from San Antonio.
Hey, John from San Antonio, my buddy. How you doing?
Okay, I'm going to get off, okay?
Okay, Bill, I hope you listen to it on the internet.
Thank you.
And,
goodbye now.
Have a good one now. Bye-bye. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I just want to push back a little bit on what the other guy, the libertarian guy, was saying.
That's Jeff McKinley.
Jeff McKinley, okay. First of all, since he made a point last week about sourcing material, I would like to see his source for the 80%, because that really totally goes against everything that I've heard. One example is if you look at Vermont, which right now has a 4.1% unemployment rate, which is one of the lowest in the country, and they also have an $8.60 $8.60 per hour
minimum wage.
So that, you know, to some degree, that's you know, shows right there that it can work. But I mean, there are other examples the other way. But I do want to read about this. This is an analysis from the Center for American Progress, which is a left wing think tank, and where he got his information is probably from a right wing think tank. But I do want to read what they say. This is Nick Bunker, David Madeline, and the University of North Carolina's T. William Lester, however, found 5 recent studies that increasing the minimum wage, even during high periods of unemployment, does not have a negative effect on job growth. A significant body of academic research has found that raising the minimum wage does not result in job losses during hard economic times. During at least 5 different economic studies, focuses on increasing to the minimum wage, including increases ranging from 7% to 12.3% during periods of high unemployment, that found increase in the minimum wage has no significant effect on employment levels. The results are likely because the boost in demand and the reduction in turnover provided by the minimum wage counteracts the higher wage costs. Similarly, a simple analysis of increases to the minimum wage on the state level, even during periods of state unemployment rates above 8%, show the minimum wage does not kill jobs. Indeed, the states are, in our simple analysis, have had growth slightly above the national average. While all the studies come to the same conclusion that raising the minimum wage had no effect on employment, while increasing the minimum wage likely has no effect on job creation, it does have a tangible benefit for workers. 8 states increased their minimum wages at the beginning of 2012, providing extra benefits to 1.4 million workers, more than half of those workers directly affected by the minimum wage increase, as well as more than half of those indirectly affected are women, meaning increasing the wages provides to help a segment of the population that already faces increasingly significant disadvantages in the workplace.
John, document I actually read. I read that document a few – actually, that's not very – that is probably like 2 years old, I think, if I recall. That's a very good document because here's an interesting thing that I think needs to be said. This is what I ask people all the time. Whenever it is like the same people who say Obamacare causes jobs or causes the loss of jobs, or when they say the increase in minimum wage causes the loss of jobs, I usually ask people to go through the analytical mechanics of how this would work, right? Let's take a McDonald's as an example. The people want $15 an hour. A McDonald's pays approximately minimum wage. Now, here's an interesting thing. McDonald's current expenses, 23% of that is labor. So increasing labor by X amount doesn't mean that $4 or $5 burger that you're talking about. It probably means something like 35 cents if you were going all the way to $15, which we probably won't get there. But if you were going to increase to $15, you're probably not talking more than about 50 cents increase in the average order of a meal at the burger place. Now, what's interesting about that, right, is the benefits that you get, because it is stimulative in the fact that, you know, first of all, we have to understand how an economy works. And 412, I'm coming to you next. An economy doesn't work by how much money somebody has in the bank. It goes by how much money somebody spends, okay? Now, that wealthy person that owns all these different businesses, and when I say wealthy, I'm not necessarily talking multimillionaire. I'm talking somebody that has a lot of disposable income. He will have less disposable income. But the less disposable income that he has immediately is immediately circulated back into the economy, which makes a more vibrant economy. And a more vibrant economy lifts the entire base. Now, that is what people have to get at. And for those who say, well, this will happen, that I'm saying no. That is what will happen because this economy is man-made. There is no market. It's man-made.
Hey,
412.
Hold on. You said 412. Something interesting.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hey, you said something interesting. That's 23%. But most companies, in comparison to their earnings, most companies are between 45% to 60%. Is their labor cost. And if 23%, that's way below. And that means McDonald's is not in line with other companies.
Well, what I'm telling you is these are the numbers that I saw quoted only by ABC.
It's good. What I'm saying now is in comparison to the normal companies, that McDonald's is paying far less to their employees than they should be, than therefore.
Oh, well, actually, if you want to be honest, if you take a look at the wealth disparity in this country and the income disparity, most companies are paying, I mean, they're paying what Jeff would call market rates because that's what the market allows. But in effect, the reason we have the disparity that we have is that the workers are so low in their own worth that they have not collectively demanded their piece of the American pie. And
hey,
that is what...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, Jeff. I want to bring in 412, but I think I've hit so much material that I think you deserve to come back in before 412. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. And I would find these discussions, you know, just personally, much more productive if we kind of took one topic and then let everybody have their say on it, because then it starts veering off everywhere. But here's just a couple things. One is. Okay, the American Economic Association, so it's an association of economists, over 73% of the American Economic Association economists believe that a significant increase in minimum wage will lead to employment losses. So that's where that statistic comes from.
But here's what's deceiving. Wait, hold on a second, Jeff. Yeah. That's what's deceiving. You named 73% of the economists in this one particular right-wing organization. That's the problem.
Well, I don't
with that.
Know. Hey, whoa. I don't even know the American Economic Association.
No, I'm telling you.
Political back?
Yes, I'm telling you. I'm telling you that they're a right-wing organization.
And can I say something, Alberto, here quickly?
No, let Jeff finish. Jeff has been quiet for a while, so let's get our libertarian some time here. Go ahead, Jeff.
I'll hit these really quickly. There's always this comparison between Walmart workers and Costco workers. Well, here's another example. You take the L.A. Lakers and you take the Clippers. They both have shooting guards. The shooting guard on the L.A. Lakers is Kobe Bryant. He makes $30 million a year. The shooting guard on the Clippers, Jamal Crawford, makes $6 million a year. That's a huge disparity. Why don't they pay Jamal Crawford $30 million? Because they don't, because it fits into the overall business model. Kobe Bryant he's more efficient at what he does. He brings in more people. I'm just saying that there's more dynamics to this, that the businesses on the ground need to make those decisions rather than looking at it and saying, you know, if you want to say that Costco employees or Walmart employees need to be paid as much as Costco employees, then you have to make the same case that Jamal Crawford needs to be making $30 million exactly like Kobe Bryant does.
And you're not going to. And, you know, I am going to, Jeff, first of all, I'm going to agree with you, but I agree with everything that you've just said with regards to the disparities between those two contracts, but I'll tell you why I don't give much concern. In as much as you're correct, I don't give much concern to the Kobe difference between the Oklahoma guy, and that is because they are not representative of the American population. That's the only reason that I don't give that a lot of, I give it credence, but I'm not overly concerned about that right now. After we're done with that,
I'm not concerned about it. I'm just using that because they both fit into the business model differently. Kobe Bryant sells a lot more product. He brings a lot more people in, which makes more money for the company as opposed to Jamal Crawford. So there's business model considerations behind what people can pay. You just can't blindly look at it and say, oh, they're both shooting guards. They both need to be making the same, just like you can't look at it and say, oh, they both work for a big retailer. They need to make the same amount of money.
But okay.
It's more trouble.
Egberto, can I say one thing here?
Sure, go ahead, John.
One quick one to your libertarian friend. How does he feel that since the employees at companies like Walmart don't make so much that they have to be subsidized on welfare?
Well, see, now this is the other thing that I get to, and I think that if you want to take the position that it's the moral imperative upon society that people have to earn this living wage, a basic minimum, why does that total responsibility get hoisted upon an employer? Why?
You know what?
They're siphoning off the government. How do you feel about that?
John, I want to answer that. I really do.
Because you've got to look at the productivity of that employee. So
I really want to answer that.
Let's get back to the Jamal Crawford.
No. Jeff, I think you made your point, and that's a very good point that you made. Jeff, you've made an excellent point. You've made a very excellent point. Your point is if you can make a moral statement and want a moral society to abide by certain principles, why throw that on the backs of these corporations or these businesses? I'm 100% in agreement with you. That's the reason I want healthcare out of the hands of businesses, because I consider it a moral issue. That is why I gave you a chance to finish.
Sure.
That is why I want I want employers to concentrate on their business and their business only. But because the union is at fault with this as well, because they have allowed pay for health care and pay for all these other things, we get a distorted market. What I want is I want the moral parts of our society to be run by we, the people, our government. All the other shenanigans can be run by the companies, the corporations, or whatever. We have to make that delineation. When I wrote that book, As I See It, Class Warfare, The Only Resort to Right-Wing Doom, that is exactly what I delineated. I don't hate corporations. I don't hate government. I don't hate anything. I just think we have to have the right balance. And the right balance doesn't mean maximization of profits for a few. The right balance means that people can live in a society just like our Constitution said, in the beginning, the preamble of our Constitution, we the people of the United States, in order to live a whatever it says, the beginning, that we want to have these values to be self-evident. But let me get to 412 before I forget the entire Constitution altogether, like I just did while getting excited. 412, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hello, Egberto and Greg.
Hey, Greg, can you speak up a little bit? Your mic's a bit low.
How is this?
Excellent, my friend. Talk to me.
Better? Okay. Well, first of all, this is a very stimulating discussion. As the host, and as one of your callers, I would never be opposed to you using the mute function occasionally. Sounds like you could have used it a couple of times already this morning, just to try and control the conversation a little bit. But I wanted to really ask your libertarian friend if he's willing to share with us a couple of things. What's the cornerstone of his ethical belief system, and what does he do for a living?
Jeff,
I'm always curious about that. With libertarian,
I'm a business owner and a CPA.
You're a business owner.
Yeah.
How big a business?
What's that?
How big a business?
It's a small business.
Do you have any employees who make minimum wage?
I have employees that make far, far multiples of minimum wage.
That's what I thought. Okay. And what about the cornerstone of your morals and your ethics? What would you say?
I also say that we have top-notch health plans, and the company pays 95%, even for families. The cornerstone of my political philosophy, everything based upon voluntary transactions. And
not that. I'm asking about your morals and your ethics.
Like, can you give me an example on that?
Not your politics, your morals and your ethics.
I think, Greg, you probably need to explain exactly what you mean, because, what do you mean by his moral and his ethics? Is he religious?
Okay, that's fine. I'm happy to do that. The libertarian principles, as I understand them, seem to be rooted in selfishness and greed. Just wondering if maybe our libertarian friend professes to have any sort of, Judeo-Christian religious values that he's maybe in conflict with when it comes to some of the beliefs that the libertarians espouse.
So do you think I'm a libertarian? I'm a very hardcore libertarian, and I pay 95% of my employees' health care costs, which probably runs me about $20,000 per employee. Am I greedy?
No, you see, Jeff. You see,
is that greedy?
You are not.
No,
Jeff.
But
here's the problem.
If you're so good to your own employees, why do you care about what Walmart, what Greg suggested.
Greg is suggesting, right, I take more control of the mic, which I don't want to. But so, Jeff.
Let me elaborate on that. So there's one example where I'm a libertarian, and I would say I'm probably not greedy, since I do have those benefits. I also buy everybody lunch every day. That costs me another $20,000 a year.
That's
so
perfect.
I look to take care of people, but the difference is I look to take care of people on a voluntary basis. No one is forcing me to do that. When you go out and you use force and coercion to get other people to do what you want and to subject them to your will, that's where we have a problem. I'm not saying that charity and treating people well, and also I know it's a free market. And if I don't treat my employees well, as I feel I morally should, they're going to go somewhere else. So you've also got that constraint in there, too.
I want to get in here now.
I
got to get in here. I need to get in here. Now I'm going to pull. Here's what I want to tell you, Jeff. And I'd like everybody to hear this. You see, I've spoken to Jeff a whole lot of times. I've spoken to Jeff by emails. I've spoken to Jeff over Facebook, etc. The problem that I see with Jeff is honestly, everything that I know about Jeff, a very moral person, takes very good care of his employees, and not only that, has very good social values. The problem is Jeff is an anomaly. Jeff is not what would be considered a business standard in today's society, and Jeff as a libertarian is a poor example for us to use with all that is wrong with libertarianism, because – if you listen to something that Jeff just said, you know, Jeff said he doesn't want coercion, meaning he doesn't want the government to tell him what to do. He can be good all on his own. Unfortunately, that's not reality. Society is not good all on its own, and current societal, the way society is today is probative that that is not the case. And the case is not, it, society is not the way it is because government is bad and inefficient. Society is the way it is because corporations have taken the liberties to destroy government. And we have to be honest with each other. And again, Jeff, what I'm trying to tell you specifically is, as a man, as a businessman, you are everything that I think a good businessman is supposed to be. Unfortunately, for some businesses, and especially corporations, which are man-made entities, those things have to be legislated by we the people. We the people have to decide. We are a society. We decide a society what the norms are going to be. The reasons we have the military. We as a society decide that. Not the individual people that have influence over. Because after all, we the people are the ones who make America what it is. We the people are the ones who fight the wars. So when a libertarian that is no good asks for these things, we're the people who are left holding the bag.
Can I just add a couple points there?
Absolutely.
Because I think that, what you said about, you know, me being, you know, kind of the anomaly in the libertarian, I'll keep that in mind and I'll keep on the lookout to see. But also there's another pops into my head here, the Bleeding Heart Libertarians, which are libertarian philosophers, professors, and they have some very good points out there. But a couple of things that I wanted to point out. Libertarians believe a lot in Milton Friedman, and they believe a lot in Friedrich Hayek and the Austrian economic views, which is pricing systems and something that, you know, I think needs to be pulled apart from social welfare. But both Hayek and Friedman had proposed a standard minimum income. It just wouldn't be, you know, as I said before, it just wouldn't become enforced on a business because they don't want to interrupt that market. They want people to work. They want them to get out there. You don't want to interrupt and put sand in the gears of the economy that's going to produce good stuff for you. But Hayek and both Friedman said we need a minimum standard, and that would be primarily through a negative income tax.
Here's
so people
the deal.
Wouldn't fall below.
Can I speak, Egberto?
Yes, I'd like, because I wanted to refute that, but I think you're going to do a good job of that, John. Go ahead, please.
Well, first thing I'd like to just talk about a little breaking news because I think it is very important. Obama just spoke. They interrupted all the news programs, and he's saying that he is going to have a debate in Congress about this, and I think that's a very positive. I know we haven't spoken about this, and so I think this is a very positive step, and I think we should look for anything positive that's going right now in our political system. So I think we should have this debate. Of course, I am against intervention, but we should definitely have a debate.
Hey, John, thanks for bringing the serious stuff. We talk about that after, but I really want to address you to address Jeff with what he just said.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the thing about Hayek is that basically he was completely discredited before. I mean, he was not popular at all. One of the best parts of The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein was when Milton Friedman was talking to Nixon. This is in the early 70s, and basically Friedman took his plan, which was basically the plan that Jeff was just talking about.
The Chicago Boys plan, yes.
Right. This mythical markets is actually more important than morality. I mean, the morality of having people being able to feed themselves, be able to have health care, and to have a living wage so they can have a roof over their head for their family and for themselves. And so when Friedman went to Nixon, Nixon said, I believe in a lot of what you say, but if I were to say that to the public, I would get killed. I couldn't win another election. Now, this is in the early 70s, and so he said, there's no way I'm going to start saying this stuff. Well, by 1980, Reagan started this. You know, basically, the Friedman Plan was adopted, and it's called supply-side economics or trickle-down economics. And this is when the whole idea of income inequality drastically changed. It just switched, radically. And it's really been terrible for the last 30 years since that. So,
but
when he says, he does these things for the people, I hope he's being sincere, but it just is from a pure moral standpoint. And you talk about this quite a bit in your blogs. What I think is that people should have a right to health care as a human right.
Exactly.
If you were born, you should have a right to health care. I also believe that you should have a right to have a roof over your head. Now, that's a little bit more radical. And also, you should be able to have food. And like the other guy said, this should be worldwide. Now, it's very hard in the third world for that to happen. But it could definitely happen in America.
Actually,
and so when you say...
It's not hard at all. Even in the third world, it's not hard. What happens is, if you remember from the Naomi Klein book, what one of the things that happened with the Friedman policies were all these guys educated at the University of Chicago went throughout Latin America, throughout South America to try to push these types of policies, which in America, they couldn't push as drastic as they did in Argentina and Chile and all these other places. And it proved how... unworkable they really were. You talk about whether we could have everybody under a roof, a right to under a roof and a right to health care. What we should be saying is it's not possible for humanity not to have that. And if our economic system cannot solve that problem, then the economic system has failed. I want to read the last paragraph in what I have going on Daily Cost again because it's important. There are millions of jobs that need to be done. The failure of this man-made economy prevents it. Those who have studied macro and microeconomics may balk at this point. However, it should be noted that an economic system is not divine. It is man-made. It is if the current economic system works inordinately well for a few and not as well for most, then it has inherently failed. If there are millions of workers looking for jobs and millions of jobs waiting to be done and they cannot be matched, it means the economic system has failed. If the system inhibits change, then one is enslaved to that system. If one is enslaved to that system, one is not free. There is no democracy if one is not free. And that is what I don't know how better to explain this to Jeff. It is not about taking away Jeff's freedom. Yes, go ahead, John.
Can I say something and ask to Jeff, for which he didn't answer the one question that I had.
Okay, I want to change the tone of the conversation.
Hold on, one thing.
No, wait, John. John, hold up. John, hold up.
Yeah.
Here, we want to maintain a high level conversation. Let me finish. I don't want this to sound as if it's a beat up on the libertarian type of a conversation.
Oh, no, we're not here.
Okay. Yeah,
now, let me go about this whole thing about the evil of government, okay, the evil of government. Now, what about the evil free reign of corporations, okay? What about the plant that exploded in Texas and that not being regulated? What about all these carnivals?
Very good point.
All these carnivals that in most of the states right now, none of these carnival rides and such and rides in these amusement parks are being regulated at any point right now, and that the corporations could do what they want, and that what happens in regards to the safety of people who are on these rides, not knowing what's the real safety issues of these rides that they're on. Now
again, you've changed the subject. You've changed the subject away from minimum wage.
It's a good point, though. But the other thing is, I'd like him to go back, if he could, and I'm not bashing him, but I haven't heard a good answer. What about Walmart paying such far low wages that these people have to be supplied by the government on welfare?
Good question. Let him answer, Jeff.
Well, that gets back to, I actually did answer that, which was that if you think that there's a moral imperative that people have a minimum, you know, standard of living, why does that moral imperative and all the obligation, 100% of the obligation, why is that to be placed on a business? Why don't you cut a check for these people?
But they will get to a point where they will be on welfare, and we know what that level is. So they will be on welfare. So now what about Walmart's standard of not raising their standards so that these people are not on welfare and that we and his government are helping Walmart basically through a welfare program, which most conservatives and even libertarians, I would say, are against, that the welfare state is now our government, our taxes, you and me and everybody else is now paying for people who are not being funded properly at Walmart.
Well, if they don't have the – no one's made the case that they have the marginal input into the end product. If someone's making $7 an hour and they have a marginal input of $9 an hour, there's a small profit margin there for the company. If they have $9 an hour of input into the revenue streams of the company and you raise it to $15, either – they have to pay them $15 and lose $6 on every hour they pay them.
But you're not trying to say that Walmart has low profit.
Okay, here's the deal. I had to mic you for a second, John, because you didn't give me a chance to get in here. Jeff, I'm going to put you back on, John, as soon as I'm done. But here, Jeff, is something that I would love all true blue capitalists to understand. You had such a good argument there. If what that person added marginally for that product, what has he added to that product for profit, or what value has he added to that product? Exactly. And that's my point about shareholders. That's my point about how our economy works. That guy who sits down with $1 billion, he has zero. He has zero that he provides as far as marginal benefits for the for whatever a product that is brought into to society. Marginal benefits for marginal value for the service that is provided. What he has is capital, and because we are a capitalist society, we chose, it's man-made, we chose to say that capital has more importance than labor. Capital has more value than labor, and that is what personally and within the different movements that I am within stayed in. Capital should have no additional benefits. Capital should have no value over that of what humans provide.
So I know that you very, very much discredit capital, the use of capital. When a company's starting up, who's paying the employees? When the company hits a spot where they're losing money, so the person who has the capital and they're losing money, who needs payroll? You can't. These aren't just things where you just wave a wand and the
money. No. But what I'm saying, you're correct. But what I'm saying is, we give too much value to capital. In other words, when a company gets bankrupt, who gets paid first? Detroit is going bankrupt. Who gets paid first? I'm coming back to you, John. Give me a second here. Who gets paid first? Well, you know, we have such distorted values. When bankruptcy occurs, we don't take care of the humans first. We take care of the bondholders first. We take care of the capital first.
Well,
in other words,
it's going to be after they meet payroll.
No. What I'm saying, if you take a look at Detroit, the people that are being asked to sacrifice in Detroit right now are those people who are guaranteed pensions. Now, we want to satisfy bondholders before pensions. Humanity before capital. I mean, capital before humanity. Come on.
Hey, Berto.
Yes, go ahead.
Hey, Berto, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to echo what you're saying and maybe just challenge. Is it John? Is John the libertarian?
Jeff.
Is it Jeff?
Yeah.
Yes, it's Jeff.
Okay, sorry. So, Jeff, I've spent my whole career in high tech, most of it with small companies, and so I appreciate and actually will defend on some level the idea of the value that capital represents to entrepreneurial organizations. I think, though, we're getting off track in terms of what the real discussion, the debate, and what the decisions ought to be as a society and as government and as companies when it comes to the discussion about minimum wage. To your point earlier, and to my experience, I have not worked in a minimum wage job since I was a teenager. Things have changed. Lots of adults, lots of people trying to make ends meet are now working for very large, very profitable corporations who are not paying a subsistence wage. And I'll ask my one final question and go back on mute, the question you have yet to answer, and that is, what's at your core value? You sound like, and I'm going to make some assumptions here, you sound like a white old guy like me. Are you a Christian?
More agnostic atheist.
Okay.
If anything,
okay,
if you want to talk religion,
makes,
I would think that's a whole different discussion. I think for spirituality,
it actually makes
sense.
You can
bring quantum physics into it to explain some of this, which is a whole other topic.
Whoa! I'm giving you credit. That actually makes sense to me. I finally met a libertarian via this call that will admit that they're an atheist. Because far too much of what I'm hearing today is this hypocrisy that comes from the conservative side of our culture that wants to punish the poor while they defend the rich. And that really gets under my skin. I'm glad to have met you. You sound like a great guy. I'm glad you're treating your employees so well. And I'm glad that you don't pretend to have this false dichotomy of Christian values at the core of your being, because they do not jive one bit with libertarianism. Not
Egberto.
One bit.
Egberto.
Okay, John, come on in. I mute your mic. John, the reason I mute you is that sometimes, the flow of the conversation, go ahead.
I got you, but I'm going to stay away from the religious part because, hey, not everybody's religious. That's fine.
Right.
But first Republican was who? Lincoln, correct? We all know.
Lincoln, yes.
Right? Now, what did
yes.
Lincoln say? That labor is above capital. Without capital, there is no capital without labor. Let's go back to the first president who's Republican, the conservative, a Republican. Okay, he said it himself. There is no capital without labor. You get no production without labor.
You can't have any production or a business without capital. It's a symbiotic relationship. That's
yes.
just this whole thing of, well, it's the producer. No, it's not. It's the worker. It's the person purchasing it. It's a symbiotic relationship. And I don't know. I don't have, I don't put really any credence into.
But there's
there's
no capital production.
Jeff was saying something that I want to hear. Jeff, you're about to say something. Let me hear it. You don't give credence to.
Well, this whole idea that you're putting so much more weight either on labor or you're putting so much more weight on capital or it's the business is producing or the consumer buying, it's all a symbiotic relationship. And it's
Lincoln didn't say that. Lincoln said
Lincoln
primary.
Wasn't an
Lincoln
economist.
Said it's primary.
He's a politician
without
and a lawyer.
Labor, you
John,
cannot
you
gain,
see, we
you
need
cannot,
one at a time.
You cannot
John,
increase capital.
John,
you cannot
John,
increase capital.
John,
right.
Please. One at a time, my brother. One at a time.
Okay.
Well, I don't put much credence into Lincoln's glib saying. I just
you did say
he may have been saying that for purposes of getting some votes. But so I don't. I don't buy into that whole dichotomy. It's
okay,
symbiotic, and everybody's responsible.
Let me bring 412 into
Egberto,
the discussion.
Egberto, can I just touch on one thing? And that's the unemployment where they're looking at these unemployments saying, well, Australia has high minimum wage and they have low unemployment, or a particular state has high minimum wage and they have low unemployment. Well, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, about 73 million Americans earn hourly rates, which represents almost 60% of all wage and salary workers. So we probably have, off of that, we probably have a workforce of, let's say, 140 million. And it says here that 4.4 million workers with wages at or below federal minimum wage, so then you have 4.4 million workers who are at minimum wage out of 140 million in the whole pool. So whenever you're looking and, insane, you know, higher minimum wage doesn't affect unemployment. Well, no, we're talking, you know, we're talking less than 2% of the workforce. So that doesn't really, you know, go together. You can't look at unemployment rates overall and say higher minimum wage doesn't affect it because it's such a small percentage of the total.
But okay, can I say one quick thing here? Go to San Francisco.
John,
the city
actually,
I
need
wait,
to bring
one,
somebody
one,
into
one,
the
one.
Discussion. John, I need to bring somebody else into the discussion. 412, who do I have the honor of speaking with? 412?
Egberto, it's Greg. I'm sorry. I inadvertently disconnected, so I dialed back in.
Okay, did you have something to add?
Well, I think I'm a little curious to know what Jeff...
I can barely hear you, my friend.
Sorry about that. I love the guy and his passion, but I still have a question about what Jeff thinks. Should there be a minimum wage at all? And if so, what should it be?
Jeff,
oh,
minimum
is that a
wage
question
or not?
To me?
Yes.
No minimum wage. You don't. You don't affect. You know, you don't taint or the pricing is. People don't have respect for this, and in the Austrian economics, you know, they have a lot of respect for this, and it makes a lot of sense. Through prices come information, and you don't need to know what it is. If the price of aluminum is going up, you don't need to know that there was a plant in Chile that can't make aluminum anymore, or one of the ingredients for it is now becoming scarce. That sends information through to the end, you know, to the end producers and to the end consumers. And you get a shift and you get a balance in the economy. Sorry, labor is also an input and a resource. And when you go in and you start affecting particular things through force, which is against what the normal market mechanisms are, voluntary trade, you end up tainting and distorting the market.
Who said, okay,
so, no,
John,
anyway.
Jeff, this is where we're going to disagree here.
Yeah.
There is, you know, you believe in a mythical market. I do not. I believe
it's
that
man, it's a myth.
Not mythical.
Okay, let me ask you this, Mark. Who determined this famous market that you're talking about? Who determines that? What you know? Where did that come
Nobody.
From?
Nobody. It's not of human action, but it is not of human design. If you read The Use of Knowledge in Society by Hayek, he outlines it very well.
And that's
no
the point.
Way
I don't
billions. There's the billions of transactions out there every day. Nobody has the ability to, number one, capture that information, and nobody has the ability to properly analyze it to come up with a policy decision. And knowledge is too far dispersed. Egberto, did you have coffee today?
Yes.
What, did you have a creamer in your coffee?
No.
Okay, no cream. Did you have a large? Did you have a small? Well, yesterday
I had
a large.
Starbucks venti.
Okay, there you go. So those will change every day, and when you bought that, you just now affected the whole market. You affected
yes, I did.
Starbucks, you affected the coffee market, you affected coffee growers. How can somebody, that's just one transaction, how can
but
anyone
you know what?
Capture that
yeah.
information to make
I don't, let me tell you what I capture, what I tell you is I don't care, and let me tell you what I mean by I don't care. What I care of is knowing that I am defining societal values. I'm defining that this is how we will operate. I am a man, you are a man, and this is what we are going to make happen. We are going to determine what money is. We're going to determine all these particular issues, and then as long as this earth has the capability to grow enough food for everybody, as long as this earth has enough raw materials that we can burn oil and all these things, I am not going to allow a mythical market to determine exactly how things flow in such a manner that when this mythical market screws up, people die. In other words, I am not going to allow that, nor do I believe that. And I think it's been proven that it's been a failure. We just have to look at what this mythical market has done to the American society.
No. Command and control markets have been absolute failures. That's what's been a failure.
Can I say something, Alberto?
Not yet.
Let's
get Greg and then John. Greg, then John. Greg, go ahead.
So Greg, I would, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I think I might share with Jeff two words in terms of how this data is managed and understood today. Those two words are big data. If you think corporations don't know that Egberto had a venti today, you don't understand how markets actually do work. As far as this mythology of a perfect free market, you can continue to believe Russian novelists, but it is a fallacy. It's a fantasy. Without regulation, people will rise in power and do bad things to most of us if they are not kept in check. The market can't control that. That's a myth. It's actually a juvenile myth. You know, this is the sort of thing that teenagers might believe, but adults should not.
Can I speak, Greg, finish his point.
I'm going to go in order, guys.
That's my point. That's my point. Is that Randian capitalism is a juvenile mythology. It really is. It proves individuals who think that way actually don't give a shit about anybody else but themselves. And I don't know how society can be expected to function like that.
Okay, John, go ahead and make your point now, John. John from Jersey.
John from Jersey first,
and then John from San Antonio. Okay. John from Jersey.
Okay, I had my point, and let me go back to it quickly.
No, I can come back. Think about it again, and
I'll
come back
to
you, I promise you.
Yeah, I'll think about it again, because I had it a second ago.
That's all right, John. John from San Antonio.
Yeah, I want to talk about there was a guy on C-SPAN a couple weeks ago who was giving a lecture, and he was talking about basically economic policy of America, and he was talking about income inequality. And basically, there was very strong income inequality from the very beginning, basically until the Depression, when the New Deal came into place, and also not just the New Deal, but Roosevelt raised the taxes on the rich. The rates were very high on the rich, and we have to remember that Roosevelt is the most prominent political figure of the 20th century, and the most beloved figure of the 20th century. And so then after World War II happened, the tax rates remained high because we had our highest deficits ever, much higher than they are now. And so the tax rates remained high, and people accepted it, that the upper class accepted high tax rates. And what, look at the tax rates under Eisenhower, and people did not, they wanted to be classless. They did not want to necessarily be a part of the upper class. And then slowly, as time went on, the tax rates went down. And like I said earlier, I mean, another thing that Nixon said is we're all Keynesians now. We all believe Keynes won the argument. He won the argument from the time from the 30s until 1981 when Reagan came into office. And so that's really the history of America. Our greatest time economically was from after World War II until 1981.
Let me tell you what was so important about that time, John. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I had to say it. And that was a time when government was really involved in managing the economy. Okay? And not only was... I'm not done yet, John. It's not only that government was managing the economy, but we also know. I mean, and this is simple arithmetic, right? In other words, if you have the accumulation of wealth, the marginal delta in wealth that's being spent. In other words, if somebody spent an extra bit of wealth, then it is not. I mean, if saved an extra bit of wealth, it is not going into the economy. They talk about, okay, well, we'll invest. No, that's not how it really works. It does not work that way. And if we ever doubt that, we just have to look at today's reality to understand that. Okay, John, make your point.
Egberto, I'd like to ask your libertarian friend, is he okay with the 10% capital gains tax?
Jeff fell off. I think he's probably lost his phone. He'll probably be back in a little bit. Say that again.
I'd like to ask him that first.
What were you asking?
Like it directly at him. Is he okay with the capital gains tax being at 10%?
He used to believe, and I can tell you because I haven't spoken to him for a long time, Jeff actually believed that there should be no taxes on capital gains at all.
Well, Well, that's basically, they're okay with suppressing that lower, and basically government intervention for adjusting that in certain ways for big business, that's okay. That kind of government intervention is okay. But when it comes, and of course here we have the separation of how high the taxes are for employees and how in regards to capital gains. And I'm just saying, I bet you, I know that would probably be his answer, like exactly what you said.
Well, yeah. Now, let me. I want to, for the last half hour, I want to go on to Syria. But before we do that, as far as the minimum wage is concerned, and I think even in the data that Jeff puts out there, he just about said it. An increase in the minimum wage cannot help in our economy, but be stimulative, because when we have an economy where we have the wealth concentration so high up, an increase in the minimum wage means that those who own these companies, who are generally are the wealthy, will have more of their money being placed into the economy. And more of their money being placed into the economy means more money will circulate. If more money circulates, you have a more vibrant economy. What this proves, however, a lot is that having capital doesn't necessarily mean knowing what's best for you. Having capital doesn't necessarily mean you have a high degree of intellect. All we have to look is that guy in New York. What's his name? Donald Trump.
No.
Having a lot of capital does not mean you know best. It does not mean you're intelligent. And
right.
And what has happened over time, if we take a look at, you know, when we talk about all the things that capitalism has done to us, I mean, it's amazing how these guys want to get rid of government intervention. But as soon as they get into trouble, when the credit default swaps hit,
right.
Who was the only person there or the only entity there to make them whole? The government.
Right.
At that point, what we should have
–
hold on.
My point, Alberto, is that they're okay for government intervention when it comes to lowering something like the capital gains from 35% all the way they did to 10%. I'm sure he's okay with that. But when it comes to other things that are against
business – I know Jeff would want that. Jeff is definitely going to want zero capital gains because Jeff has believe in preferential treatment.
And that's
capital.
Government intervention.
I don't know where that. I don't
that's
know
not
where
libertarianism.
That comes from.
Huh? I'm just saying that's not libertarianism. Then it's
no
it's,
libertarianism is almost no taxes. Period.
Yeah. But
anyhow, let me tell you guys. The truth of the matter is, we need to revamp our system. Our system has failed. We need really free enterprise. And I think in a lot of ways, a lot of libertarians really believe in real free enterprise, which I don't think we have. Now they don't. The part that they don't that they believe in is unfettered free enterprise. I'm sorry. That simply. I got another call. 630. Who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Oh, it's Jeff. I'm back again.
Hey Jeff, I knew you didn't just hang up on us. I knew you would be back.
But I heard that, you know, the conversation, and I do believe that capital gains rates should be lowered for a few reasons. One is that the effects of inflation. It's not inflation adjusted. So if you hold a capital asset for 10 years and you have inflation, you know, you could probably have a 50% inflation premium in there. Once you go to sell it, you've only kept up with inflation. You haven't kept up with the purchasing power. So you may not even really have a gain, which has occurred previously. You know, even if you had like what looked like 100% gain, you still lost money overall. So that's
and that's
one
a good
thing.
That's a good thing.
What's that?
Is an excellent thing. I mean, whenever somebody tells me, you know what, I think inflation is a good thing. In other words, paying
Whoa,
back
no, it steals from the poor. It's an invisible tax.
No. The poor don't have assets. Okay, so no, it doesn't steal from the
if
poor.
If they have any, it gets destroyed.
I love the idea, but again,
why is he for this kind of intervention?
John, the way conversations are handled one at a time, my friend. Okay, and I was speaking. I love the idea of paying back with inflated dollars. And the reason why I have no bones about paying back with inflated dollars is that I don't think the banking or the financial sector warrants the appreciation of capital they get, the amount of interest that they can charge, or any of that. So yes, pay it back in inflated dollars. And when you talk about assets losing value. That's a good thing. Why? Let me give an example. The Mayflower came to the United States of America, and we had the great westward movement. And there, I went on to the Colorado River here in Texas, not the Colorado in Colorado, but the Colorado in Texas. And we were on a dinner boat, my wife and myself, and we were going through this the length of this the Lake Buchanan. And I kept on asking, who owns all this land? And I mean, there were miles of land. And the person said, oh, it's the XYZ family. That family came and moved westward and got somehow the title to all this land that wasn't theirs to begin with. But because now they've had capital from the 1800s, they command Texas. And they can use that capital, that unearned capital, which a lot of old money in this country is unearned capital, to control everything else. What do I say to that? Inflate it down. Your point, Jeff.
But their land would go up in value with inflation because they have hard assets. What I'm thinking of is like the janitor who's worked all his life. He's saved up $100,000 or $200,000, and then he gets, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, you know, over, you know, a two-year time span, hit 25% inflation. So if he had any interest-bearing with any kind of maturity or 10 or 15, 20-year maturity, that poor guy just now lost 25% of his earnings in 2 years. It's
that
not
guy.
The wealthy know how to invest. Believe
no,
me.
John. No, They're John. There are more. John. I mean, Jeff. There are more of the unwealthy than the wealthy. If the system comes out of balance, the unwealthy is coming to take what the wealthy didn't earn. When you spoke about, you were absolutely correct. No, but it's a true thought, and that is what I'm trying to avoid. What the reason I'm in this movement is that I am from a part of the world. Where when things get out of whack, it gets more on the violent side. I don't want that in my new country. I want a peaceful transition where people are going to be made whole. Not
Egberto,
the lower 5% of the United States live better than 70% of the world.
Let me finish. Most people, period, in this country don't have the types of savings that you're talking about. Okay, and they are not afforded that savings that you're talking about because of the way we pay in this country. You were correct when you told me that land is a fixed asset that can, you know, that will hold value. But that person is going to use that fixed asset for collateral on a lot of things that he does, including loans that's been made. And that's what I'm talking about.
Maybe just start Apple.
And
can I speak, Egberto?
Go ahead. Who is that? John from
San Antonio?
San Antonio. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say that, I mean, in a lot of cases, that usually is that land does go up. But, I mean, land goes up back and forth before because I know my father, you know, has been fortunate in his life or was fortunate. And, you know, we come from, cattle ranching family, you know, going back four generations. And so I'm very familiar with the prices of land in rural land in near San Antonio. And they have mass fluctuations. I mean, let's say just since the recession of 2008, that the land dropped 25%, you know. I mean, there are massive fluctuations in the market. In the 80s, the market dropped also. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why the financial crash happened was because people didn't understand history. They thought that housing would forever go up. And it didn't. It crashed because people couldn't afford it because what we were speaking about before, they didn't have enough wages, and also the industry was not regulated, so they were able to rip people off by doing these liar loans. Excuse me?
The industry is very regulated.
It absolutely is not. Why hasn't anybody gone to jail? Why hasn't anybody gone to jail because of the financial collapse?
You're talking two different things, Doc. You want to talk about regulations, The financial industry is one of the most highly regulated industries around. J.P. Morgan has a whole floor
that,
of
that's
about 100 regulators.
That is a totally ridiculous comment.
Okay,
it's completely
let me get into this argument here. I want to get into this argument for one specific reason, because both of you stated a fact. The financial industry is one of the most regulated industry. True. And nobody went to jail? True. And why did nobody go to jail? Because it's very well regulated as well. But let me tell you what the regulations are all about. The regulations are things like, you know, if you have a student loan, the financial sector gives you a student loan, you cannot write that off as a bankruptcy while they can. That's a regulation. That's a government regulation that allows them to pilfer the middle class. They have other regulations as well. But you know what? Whenever they are in crisis, regulations don't matter, because they go into smoke-filled rooms with the executives of government and they change the rules to satisfy them. So there, John from San Antonio, you're absolutely right. They are regulated, but they're not.
Can I comment on that, Egberto?
Please do, Jeff.
You're exactly correct, because what happens is it becomes a power vacuum in Washington, and it's a hell of a lot easier to go to Jamie Dimon at Chase and get millions of dollars in campaign contributions rather than going out to 200,000 of us.
And
now,
there
Jamie
you're
Dimon,
right.
Jamie
and
Dimon,
you're right.
Jamie Dimon has specifically said that Dodd-Frank has put a moat around J.P. Morgan blocking competition. That's the problem. And that's corporatism. That's not free markets, as you said. That's not free markets. That's not capitalism. That's corporatism. And that's
now,
what
Jeff,
happens when
you and
you
I have always
abusive regulations.
You and I have agreed there on the corporatism, and we've agreed on that for years, actually. But let me just say one thing. Let me tell you what I want, and I'll put it out there. There's one sector that I think. I don't think any private sector should be controlling money. The federal, we should have private banks only in local areas, but we should have national, there should be these equity firms and so forth. Forget about that. That's crap. We can do better than that. But I don't want to go into that because that's a different discussion, and I want to change the discussion to Syria. Yes. Can we talk Syria, John?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'll talk Syria, but I would like to make one more point. You know, if you talk to William K. Black, who was a regulator during the 80s, who put all the savings, he is one of the people who actually prosecuted the savings and loan crosses during the 80s, which came out because of a lack of regulations. The lack of regulation started in the 70s. And to say that there's too much regulation is just absolutely absurd. It's like saying there shouldn't be a minimum wage. What kind of country, every country that is a industrial power, in the, let's say the top 35, that isn't a crackpot dictatorship, has a minimum wage. Name me one country that doesn't have a minimum wage,
that is
a democracy.
John,
I mean,
this is an ideological divide. The problem that I have, and I think I've told Jeff this before, is that unfortunately, or should say fortunately, we don't have to test the libertarian theory in the absolute. Because if we had to test the libertarian theory in the absolute, we'll all be doomed. I know Jeff doesn't believe that. But I can tell you that, yep. You know, I think Jeff lives through Jeff's own eyes in that because you are a good person and how you do things, you somehow believe that that is how, in general, it works. I beg to differ. Now, John from Jersey, keep going back and forth. His mic was open. Go ahead, John. I know you wanted to say something, and then I'm going to move on to Syria.
I got one thing, because I'm still on your point in your level, Egberto, but let me say something to your libertarian friend. What is the evil in the sense
to our libertarian friend? We are all
to our libertarian
to
our libertarian friend. Okay, now what is the evil in the consumer having the money? Even, you know, here is the person who consumes and makes big business run and march and keeps big business going. What is the evil in consumers, the average consumer, general public American, having money in their hands.
Okay, Jeff, just
there's
answer that.
There's nothing wrong with that. By what means?
You make it as if it, only the money should be – and the capital should be up at the top so that it could flow down and as if, you know, there's no need for the consumer to have money to purchase.
No, I've never said that. I don't,
so,
I don't
so
say,
how
it, I don't say
if,
money
if
should
you,
go, I don't say
if
money
you siphon,
should go anywhere.
If you siphon the money too much to the top, where are the consumers? Where are the consumers?
I'm not sure what point you're making.
That money doesn't get circulated, and then business starts to starve themselves.
Well, let me. I'm going to end it. Okay, I'm going to end this part of the discussion now. But let me just say one thing. I want to answer for both actually here, and that is, here's the deal, John. And why we're getting why a lot of these theories don't come to quite to fruition yet, or why business is getting away with doing what they're doing in America, it's because of the rest of the world. In other words, they no longer need that great power of the American consumer right now because they've done what they needed to do in the short term. I mean, they will lose in the long run because eventually everything is going to be normalized, which is what they're running for. What we're doing is we're currently normalizing the wages of the world. Okay, when you have the Trans-Pacific Partnership, when you have NAFTA, when you have all these other things that are going on, what you're getting is the normalization of wages across Vietnam and the United States. When that is normalized, okay, when all of these wages are normalized, there's no longer the deltas. That's when the story begins. The problem is that will take decades. The American middle class has to fall a whole lot more. And when that is over, and it will be, when that is over, we go back to exactly what we had before, which is some sort of feudalism, some sort of indentured servitude where we have those with capital and those that do everything else. The 1% or so with capital and those that do everything else. That's where we're heading, okay? And that is not where we're heading in America by itself. That is where the world is heading under the policies of these plutocrats. And the plutocrats aren't just there's no real American corporation anymore. It's the world corporations. And that is why it takes us here in America, the middle class, to really start opening our eyes to see what's really happening, get rid of these theories. Let's look out for number one first, the American middle class, and see what happens. But let's get on to Syria. Hey, John from San Antonio, tell me what the president said, because I wasn't listening to it.
Well, I mean, basically he just said that he wanted the Congress to debate it, to have a debate about what they're going to do next, which I think is a very positive thing. I mean, I've criticized Obama quite a bit, but I've also been very positive on, like, the Affordable Care Act. And, of course, you know, he's pushed back. I mean, he's not hasn't gone as far as I would like economically. But, I mean, let's face reality. I mean, you know, how can you do anything with the Republican House? I mean, how can we,
Syria?
As far as Syria is concerned, you know, that's what he said. He said, you know, let's have a debate. Of course, he condemned the Syrian Assad and all the chemical weapons. You know, the fact that they used them. So, you know, I'm trying to read the closed caption on my TV while I'm trying to keep up with the conversation. But, I mean, that was basically what I got out of it. He only spoke for about 5 minutes, maybe.
You know what?
Minutes.
I'm so happy about, John. First of all, there are two things that I know a lot of people – I looked at a lot of things that started to take effect. First of all, they weren't going to be able to impeach this president. However – I don't think they would have gotten any kind of votes because there's nothing that this president has done. But I thought, in as much as Clinton did it, Bush 1, Bush 2 did it, meaning put Americans in arms way without getting congressional authorization, I think they were going to set up the narrative if the president intervened to start talking. And this has nothing. This is just political now. This is no ethical or moral anything. They would have used the president. I think that's probably what the attorney general probably told him, if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly. They would have used him going into Syria, sending these missiles into Syria as war, and then impeached him for doing something unconstitutional. And then that's all we would have been talking about, in as much as the Senate would not be able to impeach him unless they took over back in 2014, or rather 2015. So it's
You still need to have two-thirds vote, so there's no way they're even going to get two-thirds votes of the Senate.
Oh, wait,
so,
is the Senate two-thirds? Is the Senate two-thirds for the impeachment?
Yeah, you have to actually be removed from office, you have to have two-thirds of the votes.
In the Senate. But impeachment is majority vote in the Congress.
In the House, yes.
In the House. It's majority vote in the House. Okay.
Right.
The House votes to send it to the Senate for the true impeachment.
Impeachment from office. Yeah, because President Clinton was impeached. He just was not removed.
Right. The House approved with over 51%, which means that they go to full impeachment procedures, to where if the Senate says such, then he is truly impeached.
Right, exactly. Now, but correct me if I'm wrong, folks, isn't it? I think impeachment is what the Congress does, and removal from office because the president was impeached is what the Senate does, right?
The House starts the impeachment procedures and says that yes, the president is to be of impeachment procedures by the Senate.
Okay. Well, anyway, what I thought is that if he had gone through with this, successful or not, I think that is what these guys would have used as the aha moment, here is the definition. Impeachment is a formal process in which an official is accused of unlawful activity, the outcome of which, depending on the country, may include the removal of that official from office, as well as a criminal or civil punishment. But anyway, that's what I thought. I am glad that he's doing that, because I think that would put some more honesty back into the process, because these presidents, all of them, have been going crazy. When was the last time we were not in a war? Can anybody remember that? Does anybody remember that? The last time we were not in a war?
Carter.
It was before Afghanistan.
It was with Carter.
Yeah, Carter was the last time we had a period with no war. That's a shame.
No, you had the Gulf War till the Afghanistan War. We weren't at war during that time. I mean, we had airstrikes on Kosovo and things like that. But I mean, with actual ground troops, it wasn't Jimmy Carter. I mean, after the Gulf War ended. During Clinton's term, Clinton wasn't in a war. He never had ground troops in any. We just had bombing in Kosovo.
You're splitting hairs, my friend.
Well, it's not splitting hairs. When no sure. Americans die, you know, from that. I mean, that's how we define war.
So that's how we define war, with bombs and people dying that aren't Americans don't count as war, huh?
Okay.
Well, no, I'm not saying I
that's
necessarily
fine, guys.
Approve.
Here, we got to go to closing statements now, because I only have a few minutes left. So I'm going to start with you, John, since you're speaking from San Antonio.
Yeah, I would like to say that, you know, I really enjoy what you've been writing on Daily Kos, and right now I guess it's probably still on the recommended list about your thing about Obamacare, and I just really, you know, hope that these workers can get a decent wage, you know, and it's very, very important that people actually are able to live, to you know, feed their families, to put a roof over their heads, to have consistent meals, and I think that's extremely important, and I just hope the ACA comes into effect. I know Obama and Biden and Bill Clinton are going to be pushing this, and probably Hillary Clinton also. They're going to be going out on the road and pushing the ACA, and I hope that people accept it and people realize how much it's going to help them.
I think they will, John. And I tell you what it's going to take, though, is for all of us to remain engaged. And thank you for being engaged. I am engaged. All of us, the mere fact that we're on this show, are engaged. But we got to stay engaged. And again, as I always say, we got to recover what belongs to the middle class. Jeff is going to have a little different opinion. Go ahead, Jeff. You're on.
Just a couple things. One, and just going back to a couple things, and then I'll close here. If you're under 16 in Australia, you can make $5.87. That's a minimum wage. If you're 16, you make $7.55, and then it goes up from there. So they do have lower minimum wages. Regulations in the economy is estimated to cost $1.7 trillion a year. That's compared to $2.5 trillion the government normally brings in. So it is heavily regulated. And Naomi Klein has a philosophy. She studied philosophy and literature. No economics degree, no degree at all. I don't put a lot of credence in what she says economically. And just to close on Robert Nozick's quote, there's room for words on subjects other than last words. Thanks for the debate.
Thank you very much for being here, Jeff. And thank you for staying. I hope you come back. You keep coming back, in fact, buddy.
Okay
Greg. Well, come on, Greg. You're up.
This was, as usual, a very engaging discussion. I think everybody here has done a great job of expressing their opinions. We don't always agree, obviously, but it's a welcome opportunity to share those kind of opinions. And I guess the only thing I would say about all of this is that I've never used money as the measurement of our society and what it should strive to achieve. There's plenty to go around, and we've got to continue to make sure that false facts don't go unchallenged.
Thank you very much, Greg. John from Jersey.
Yeah, well, I'd still like to sort of, you know, but quickly, I'm just going to debate it myself here with the audience. And basically, I'm going to say that has to do with San Francisco. San Francisco has the highest minimum wage in the country, and it additionally has about one of the highest, for its employees. It has the highest salaries given out to its employees, and it has one of the absolute lowest unemployment rates in the country. So, you know, your thing does not hold water.
Thank you very much, John. Guys, please remember that we have four radio shows on Coffee Party. But before I go there, I want to make a statement. Last week we had a show where a few of our Coffee Party members came up and sort of gave some of the things that they wanted us to do, how more proactive they wanted us to be, how much more engaging they wanted us as the Coffee Party to be, more involved in issues. And we are working diligently here at the board to get that done. We'd like to continue hearing from all you Coffee Party members, Coffee Party listeners, Coffee Party followers, all of you, to help us do what we are intended to do, get money out of politics and ensure that corporate personhood is not damaging to the American body politic. Now, to do that and to continue, we have to have the funds to keep these doors open, the internet open, to keep the databases open that we run. So I implore you all to join Coffee Party. You can join Coffee Party for just about anything. You can give a donation, or you can join the Coffee Party by giving us $5 a month, $10 a month. That helps us pay the bills. Those of us that you see here, myself, you know what we make? Zero. This is a love of country that makes us do what we do. We really believe in making sure this country works, not just for a few, but for all, for the working middle class inclusive. So please go to Coffee Party USA, www.coffeepartyusa.com. Become an official member. We need you. We have four shows on Mondays, 10 p.m. It's Press 1 for Democracy with Dan Aronson. On Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, you have The Middle Ground with Eric Beiler. On Thursdays, you have Lunch with Loudon at 3 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, at 1 p.m. Eastern, you have Politics Done Right with Egberto. That's myself. Thank you for being here listening. Please share this show with your friends. Please share this show on your whatever social media you're using. And please encourage folks to come to us where we can have civil dialogue and where we can actually get things effected. that's what we're working towards. Thank you guys very much, and have a wonderful Saturday.